proceed to the sixth case. Butler Manufacturing versus United Steelworkers. Mr. Milicic.
May it please the court, my name is Rudolph L. Milicic, Jr., and I represent the appellant, the defendant appellant, the United Steelworkers of America. I'd like to thank the court for providing oral argument in this case because this case, in the view of the union and the workers which it represents, presents an important issue. I've reserved three minutes for rebuttal. This is the labor arbitration award enforcement case where the district court, Chief Judge McDade, vacated an arbitration award which reinstated an employee, the grievant. The arbitrator had found that the company, in discharging her, had relied upon absences that were privileged under the Family and Medical Leave Act. They were qualified under that act, and or they were absences which were medical emergencies.
Now, you argue in your brief that before the arbitrator, both sides, in fact, not just the union, but also Butler Manufacturing, spent a fair amount of time discussing the FMLA and whether FMLA excused absences were absences for, I guess the language, compelling reasons. So this was before the arbitrator presented by the parties.
That's correct, Your Honor. It was argued in detail by, in fact, the company raises in its brief more than 20 times. It refers to the FMLA. I'm talking about the brief to the arbitrator. In the grievance answer, the company also said that there were three instances which were discussed in the grievance procedure that the grievant had requested FMLA leave for each one of those instances, and that the company had reviewed them and found them not to be entitled to FMLA consideration. You have to remember that this is a unique procedure. It is, the company has an absenteeism policy, and in that absenteeism policy, it has an excuse provision. And that excuse provision says that certain matters will be excused, and it's absences of a necessary and compelling nature. Now, in 1996, arbitrator Bernstein, not this arbitrator, but another arbitrator, had the very issue of whether or not the contract provided, required, that an arbitrator look at FMLA considerations in a discharge case. Arbitrator Bernstein, and that is attached to my opinion, ruled that under Article 2, Section 13, that a discharge cannot stand if it is for if it takes into account FMLA approved absences.
Now that I mean, you know, as of course your opponents point out, that although arbitrator Bernstein's opinion is not compelling, I mean, I take it you're suggesting this simply for the purpose of pointing out that the contract itself has provisions that would open the door to the arbitrator's consideration of that statute, or for that matter, any other relevant statute.
That's correct, Your Honor. Arbitrator Bernstein's opinion is not binding on this court. It's not binding on arbitrator Cook, but it does fulfill what this court has shown in a number of decisions. That is there a signpost in this agreement for which this court can say there is a way in which this arbitrator, Arbitrator Cook, has properly had the authority to decide this case. And that's why we present Arbitrator Bernstein's opinion to this court. The second point that it makes is it explains why there was why the company did not raise this lack of authority, say to the arbitrator, Arbitrator Cook, you don't have the authority to decide the FMLA questions. They couldn't raise it because if they had, then the union would have put the Bernstein case into evidence, and said to Arbitrator Cook, you have the authority, look at this provision, look at this, look at provision, in accordance with law provision, and you have that authority. But when they don't raise it, then they can't come into court and say, Arbitrator, Mr. Arbitrator, the arbitrator did not have the authority to decide this issue when they presented it to the arbitrator without reserving their position.
Do you read this arbitration agreement? Suppose one of your union members has a grievance related to, let's say, a possible promotion, and that person thinks that he or she was denied the promotion for impermissible reasons of race, for example. In other words, I'm trying to get at something that has a statutory element to it. It's obviously unlawful to discriminate on the basis of race. Is that a kind of claim under this CBA that would go through the grievance procedure and to arbitration?
Your Honor, that is an issue which could be presented to the arbitrator because in the section which precedes Article 2, Section 13, both the company and the union have promised not to discriminate against employees based on race. So there is a specific provision. But keep in mind the language that the contract contains, and it's at page 56 of the appendix. It's Article 2, Section 13. It states that the company will offer, and I quote, continuation of employment to all qualified individuals in accordance with the provisions of law. And my point in bringing Bernstein's award and showing to this court that this arbitrator's decision is well within the mainstream of arbitral law because arbitrators rely on this kind of provision as well as the savings provision of a contract to imply law into the contract. They do it every day. The Ninth Circuit has upheld an arbitrator's decision that did exactly that under the savings clause. The savings clause is the provision of the contract here, Article 13, Section 131, that states, if any provision of this agreement is in conflict with any existing or future state or federal law, such provision shall become inoperative.
So you read that also as authority for the arbitrator to make sure that his award conforms to the requirements of the law?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There are two contractual bases for the arbitrator's decision in this case, and then there is the waiver point that the company presented the FMLA argument directly to the arbitrator, asked him to decide it. The arbitrator decided it. Now, keep this in mind. The case in arbitration is presented by the manager of industrial relations, not by a lawyer. Then the case gets into my colleague's firm, and they suddenly say, well, wait a minute. An arbitrator under two decisions of this court cannot render an opinion based on the law. Now, those decisions make it quite clear that if there's nothing in the contract, it is inappropriate for an arbitrator to apply the law. But if there is provision in the contract for the law, then there are two decisions of this court, which I've noted to the court, which hold that it's perfectly permissible for the arbitrator to do it. And I think if Your Honors will reflect on the cases you've heard today, they've had a lot to do with what people have written, what they've done. The Supreme Court of the United States has made it quite clear. An arbitrator has no obligation to write any opinion in a case at all. All he is trying to do is provide guidance to the parties when he writes an opinion. My colleague, and I think to some extent the court below, scoured the opinion to look for things which made it appear that the arbitrator was doing something wrong in this case by applying the law. That's not the job of the court, and it is not the job of the district court to interpret the savings provision and say it does not apply to the FMLA, to interpret the in accordance with law provisions of this contract and say that it does not apply to the FMLA, or to say that the arbitrator must cite those opinions. Cite those provisions in his opinion or else it will be vacated. That's not the way it works in labor arbitration. It doesn't work that way because the union has given up its right to strike over this matter. Without an arbitration clause, we could have struck over this matter. We bargained for an arbitrator's opinion. We put the FMLA issue to him as well as did the company. The arbitrator decided it, and we're entitled to enforcement of that award. I think I briefed everything that I think has to be briefed in the case. If the court has no more questions, then I'll just reserve a few minutes for rebuttal.
Very good. Ms. Golden?
May it please the Court, my name is Daryl Golden, appearing on behalf of the Appalee Butler Manufacturing Company. Before proceeding any further, Your Honors, I would like to draw your attention to one contractual provision which my opponent did not draw the Court's attention to in his presentation, and that is the provision in the collective bargaining agreement between these parties which sets forth the authority of the arbitrator in this matter. And that provision says that the arbitrator, and I'm quoting, the arbitrator shall have authority and jurisdiction only to interpret, apply, or determine compliance with the provisions of this agreement, and his decision shall not go beyond the matters in dispute.
But Mr. Golden, there are a couple things about that. You mentioned that in your brief, actually. First of all, of course, the provisions that Mr. Milicic was talking about are in the agreement. But secondly, as I'm sure you're well aware, there are sort of two classes of arbitrations. There are arbitrations that take place under an agreement that was made before any dispute arises. Most, you know, collective bargaining agreements, commercial arbitration. And then there's also ad hoc arbitration, where the parties agree after the dispute has arisen to submit a particular question to an arbitrator. Each is equally the subject of agreement. I mean, there's nothing to say it's not an agreement if you come to it after the dispute has arisen. And it seems to me, in this instance, very much like there can be trials by consent under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure for issues that didn't make it into the pleadings, if both sides submitted FMLA issues to this arbitrator, that is powerful evidence that both sides consented, whatever we may think Article 213 and Article 2131 or the article you just mentioned mean, this arbitrator had that issue submitted to him. So why isn't that the end of this?
Your Honor, frankly, I would take issue with the fact that the parties in this case submitted their dispute under an ad hoc type of agreement to arbitrate. The agreement to arbitrate was of the former type that you described. That is, an agreement that was created at the bargaining table and made part of their collective bargaining agreement.
It started out as that, but if the parties had added an issue, which is, I mean, it's just one way of looking at this. There's the agreement to arbitrate, now they've added the FMLA issue. That's another way of looking at it. I mean, I suppose the other thing I just wanted to throw out on the table is the company is in a very odd position to be arguing to us that it was actually unlawful for the arbitrator to be thinking about making sure his award conformed to federal law. We usually see the opposite, as we were mentioning in the IDS case, you know, where arbitrators are telling people to do things that don't comply with the law. That's easy enough to see is a problem. But it's a strange posture for you to be in.
Where we take issue with the proposition, Your Honor, is that by virtue of the fact that the FMLA was referred to and the parties addressed the FMLA in the arbitration, we would take issue with the fact that the parties thereby authorized the arbitrator to pass judgment upon the application of this federal statute.
But here is your, I mean, it's another point. If the arbitrator had before him evidence, which he seems to have had, that under the attendance policy there had been a relation between FMLA absences and absences for compelling reasons, you know, excused for compelling reasons, we get into the line of cases, or at least I'm reminded of the line of cases, that say that labor arbitrators can look at the common law of the shop. Labor arbitrators can look and see the way parties handle the meaning of a particular thing. And certainly one of the things this arbitrator, you would agree, I'm sure, was being asked to do is whether this person's excuses were excused or not.
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor. But in this case, and in every situation in which an employer is addressing the rights of one of its employees, which can arise under a collective bargaining agreement or a external statute, the company, of course, has to be mindful of adhering to those rights no matter from which source they might arise. In this case, the arbitrator was authorized by both parties jointly to pass judgment upon one very limited aspect of those potential rights of the grievant in this matter, and that is her rights arising under the collective bargaining agreement. He was not authorized to serve as a judge and pass judgment upon her statutory rights.
What if he'd never written an opinion? Would you be here?
If he had never written an opinion,
except for the relief part, you know, she's reinstated in this very limited way with enough points to keep the sword of Damocles hanging over her, and
it's very, very possible we would not be here, Your Honor. But in this case, the arbitrator wasn't silent on where he found the path to pass judgment on the Family Medical Leave Act rights. The arbitrator actually expressed in his opinion. He said, I cannot find that the company's policy violates the collective bargaining agreement. I cannot find that the company under the collective bargaining agreement doesn't have the right to limit the number of excused absences. He says, I recognize the grievant had enough absences to justify her discharge. But he says that he feels, and I'm borrowing his words, that he would be, quote, delinquent in his responsibilities, unquote, if he did not look to the FMLA and apply the rights as he understood them under that statute to the grievant in this matter. In other words, the arbitrator acknowledged that he couldn't find a violation of the collective bargaining agreement. He felt some personal responsibility to go beyond the collective bargaining agreement.
And why isn't Article 213 that talks, I mean, the judge didn't quote it correctly, and you highlighted, or actually italicized, the words offers equal opportunity for employment, but it also says continuation of employment in accordance with the provisions of law. Why did you put that in there if you didn't want arbitrators to look to provisions of law?
The provisions of law language, Your Honor, we submit, refers solely to anti-discrimination statutes.
But why do you say that when it's in the conjunctive? Offers equal opportunity for employment, comma, and continuation of employment.
The provision follows a paragraph.
That follows paragraph 12, I know.
Which is an anti-discrimination paragraph.
But why, and in fact, why isn't she being discriminated against because she used too much FMLA leave? I mean, you could play that the other way, too, if you wanted to. But it's language in the agreement that invites consideration of provisions of law.
Your Honor, we would submit that the provision in paragraph 13 is only addressing the anti-discrimination statutes, which are commonly recognized to be Title VII, the Age Act, and so forth.
I understand, but why is it the court's responsibility to interpret paragraph 13 if there's an arbitration agreement? Don't we have lots of cases that say that very act is for the arbitrator?
Your Honor, the arbitrator is the party that should interpret the collective bargaining agreement. In this case, the collective bargaining agreement contains the provisions of law paragraph, which, as I've said, we contend relates solely to Title VII and other clear anti-discrimination statutes, but it also contains the provision that expressly limits the arbitrator to the interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement. We would submit that he is limited to the four corners of the agreement. I could not find a reference to the Family and Medical Leave Act in the agreement. The arbitrator was made aware of it because the company had notified the grievant in this matter that if her absences were covered by the FMLA, they would be excused. By law, the company had no choice.
But, so I take it, though, would your position be, because the agreement doesn't mention Title VII either, that the combination of sections of Article 212 and 13 means that if somebody had a discrimination claim, they're entitled to go straight to federal court, they don't have to arbitrate that?
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, I think the U.S. Supreme Court dealt with that issue in the Gardner-Denver case.
Oh, long before they decided lots of other cases about statutory arbitration.
Yeah, I'm not saying that the grievant wouldn't have had the right to ask that her discrimination claim be submitted to an arbitrator, but she could have ignored the procedure that was available to her under the collective bargaining agreement and gone to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and ultimately to the federal courts.
Okay.
In considering whether the decision of the lower court vacating the arbitrator's award should now be affirmed, there are two important points Appellee requests the court to consider. First, the point I've already made, that the contract from which the arbitrator derived his authority clearly and unambiguously limits the arbitrator solely to the interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement. Secondly, the arbitrator in this matter exceeded his authority, and his award is rendered unenforceable by virtue of the fact that in total disregard of the limits placed on his authority, the arbitrator proceeded to rely entirely and solely upon external law, the Family and Medical Leave Act. The parties bargained for an arbitrator's interpretation and solely an interpretation of their collective bargaining agreement, but that is not what they got. It is, as a result, the arbitrator's award was properly vacated by the district court, and that judgment should now be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Golding. Mr. Milicic?
If I may, the only thing I would like to emphasize is the point which my colleague made, and that is that the company on two occasions sent this woman a letter which said the company letters assured her and other employees that absences will be excused as compelling if, quote, qualified under the FMLA or are clearly of an emergency nature. That was what they had to do to make their rule effective. That's why they had to argue the case the way they did to the arbitrator, because she was claiming that they were FMLA qualified, and that letter is quoted in the arbitrator's opinion. He understood his authority, he issued his rule, and please keep in mind that this woman is not getting away scot-free. There was a substantial punishment imposed on her because she was not notifying the company as she should have under the policy. She's lost half of her back pay, and she's under a year probation where enough points so that if she would undergo a wrongdoing or fail to comply with the policy, she would be discharged.
When is the probation up?
1 year. From the date she's reinstated, Your Honor. She has not yet been reinstated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Milicic. Thank you, Mr. Golden. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.